Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne, and on this edition, an air pollution crisis is gripping South Asia. Schools in Delhi are shutting their doors and Lahore is blanketed by smog so thick it's visible from space. In Spain, political pressure builds as Valencia's leader faces backlash over the deadly October floods. We'll hear from Spain's economy minister on the government's response. We'll also hear how the conflict in Israel and Gaza is impacting the Egyptian economy.
People don't want to travel to places which is even near to wars. Why should you? Are you expecting a lesser number if more of the wars and more of the military activities which are taking place around Egypt will happen? Yes, of course.
Plus, a 7-year-old programming prodigy from Russia wows the tech world. Could he be the youngest head of training in a major IT company?
For me, it looks like absolutely amazing. He has been teaching other people when he got 5. And for me, it's a kind of a new Mozart.
It's really amazing stuff. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033. We'd love to hear from you about what you've learned on YouTube, maybe, or any other social media. Have you started a side hustle? Or, of course, you can always email us anytime at world.business@bbc.co.uk. But first, let's start with a tale of two cities at World Business Report as we discuss the impact of pollution on two South Asian cities, one in Pakistan and one in India. Just a moment, we'll go live to Delhi, where schools have closed and moved classes online as pollution levels soar to 60 times the World Health Organization's recommended limit. The crisis has also engulfed Pakistan's second largest city, Lahore, where clouds of smog are so dense they're visible from space. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davies has more.
Lahore was known as the City of Gardens. Now the soundtrack to its streets is traffic noise, not birdsong. In the last 2 weeks, air quality has hit unprecedented toxic levels here. Some, like rickshaw driver Asif Ali, say they cannot escape it.
We are compelled to go out because we have children. If we stay home, what will we do? We have to earn our livelihood. There is no other option. Not everyone is a job holder. We are labourers. We need to earn to be able to eat.
In the University of Lahore's teaching hospital, Dr. Irfan Malik estimates he's seen up to a 25% increase in patients on his ward.
These all patients mostly present with increase in cough and worsening shortness of breath, and they are having classical asthmatic symptoms. And remember one thing, we are all not asthmatic, but this is weather which is aggravating them.
He's worried that winter is almost here.
In coming 1 or 2 weeks, there will be the cold wave that will hit this Lahore and major cities of Pakistan. So cold waves along with the smoke is a lethal weapon. And I am expecting there will be significant surge in the respiratory diseases.
Lahore's markets are far from empty, but some have no choice but to stay inside. Iram Adnan has 3 children, 2 with special needs.
Cough is not going. Everyone has in our home is having cough, and these 2 kids are more affected with smog as compared to the other people in the home. The kids with special needs have low immunity.
Very good. 3-1. Finish. Smile. 3-1.
Schools are closed. So are the parks. Iram keeps the children occupied with indoor board games, but it's difficult.
They are greatly disturbed by all this haphazardness because they don't have anything to do. It is very difficult to survive in this environment, and we are thinking that it's high time to shift somewhere because every day we are affected by it.
Pakistan sees smog most years. The provincial government insists it was trying to control it, but hadn't prepared for this level, says Raja Jahangir Anwar, the environment minister in the Punjab government.
Air quality index is beyond our control, and I must admit that it is actually a surprise for us. We were not ready to face such kind of surge in AQI. Whole of the government is actually working towards mitigation of smog. We know that this is a long battle.
Pakistan's pollution problem has not come out of thin air. It's built up over years. Change will take money and political will. If they fail, millions may stay trapped in these toxic clouds.
So that's the picture in Lahore. And we now cross to our reporter, Davina Gupta, who is in Delhi. Hello, Davina.
Hi, Liaram. It's just past 9 p.m. here in Delhi, and I was listening to that report from Pakistan, and I can say it's similar situation, if only worse, here in the capital city of India. I am on my terrace, and usually in this winter night, one could call it in November because it's onset of winter, I would be able to see stars, I would be able to take a stroll here. But right now, I can only see a dust and a haze smog above me. There are no stars. It's very difficult to breathe. Every breath is taking so much effort, and I'm so conscious of it. And it's also causing irritation on my throat. My eyes are stinging, and that's the visible impact of this pollution. It's enveloped the city, and you can just see the dust particles in the air, and it is quite thick.
It sounds really, really tough. What are you doing to mitigate that on yourself, on your health?
Well, I'm able to at least be on the privileged side of it, Liana, because I can have an air purifier. I'm wearing a mask as I speak with you. I can choose to be indoors, but there are many who have to be at work, especially those who are from the vulnerable sections of our society. There are near over 30 million people who live in this city, including children and families. There are those who have to go out and earn their wages and work. And I was able to speak to some of them today.
I put a mask on my face, but I couldn't breathe. My throat itches and my clothes get dirty, and the face is covered with dust all over because of pollution.
I come in every day at 6 a.m. with my cart to sell vegetables. Today, because of this pollution, there are very few customers and there is a feeling of dust getting in my eyes. It's so uncomfortable, but this is my job, so I have to do it. Otherwise, where will I get the money from? 75% of my business is gone. I'm planning to go back to my village if this situation continues.
I drive this rickshaw and stay on the road for over 12 hours each day. And today, since the morning, my eyes are burning. I drink hot tea and water, but my body doesn't feel any different.
My eyes are stinging and I've been coughing, but I am a labourer, so I can't sit at home. I have to work.
Now, Davina, what are companies in Delhi doing to adjust their operations? Because they're facing a higher cost now because of pollution control measures, aren't they?
Well, that's right, Liana. Also, they're facing productivity loss because a lot of people who are not able to make it to work because of allergies or respiratory diseases, they're taking sick leave. There are health costs also involved with this. But more than that, there are also people who have decided to leave Delhi during this period, those who are particularly vulnerable in this weather. Construction activities have been put on hold here. Sectors that are clearly impacted are tourism, because this is also a month where India attracts a lot of foreign tourists who are now staying away from the capital city and the nearby areas, including the very popular Taj Mahal. I saw some pictures in the morning. It was also covered completely with dust cloud. So that is another hit for India's economy. Many businesses are now also starting staggering shifts. They've allowed some people to work from home. But as you can hear perhaps around me, the traffic still at this hour is going on. So many people are just walking out. They're braving this pollution, reporting to work, and businesses, those who can, are open as usual.
Okay, Davina Gupta in Delhi, we appreciate your time, but also we really hope you look after yourself. Thank you so much, Davina. Now, we head to Egypt to take a look at how its economy is being impacted by conflict in Israel and Gaza, something that our reporter Hannah Mullane has been looking into. And she joins me now in studio. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, nice to be with you.
I'm glad you're here. Now, tell me, Egypt's economy is already struggling, wasn't it, before the conflict started in Israel?
Yes, it absolutely was. Before the conflict started, the economy there was in crisis. Prices were rising. The Egyptian pound's value was falling against the dollar, which just meant there was less currency available to import goods. And the weak economy meant that investment in the country was low as well. And then the conflict started in neighbouring Israel, and that made all of these things even worse. Small Egyptian businesses were really taking a big brunt of the hit there. I spoke to Yara Yassin, and she runs an eco-friendly fashion company in Cairo. She told me it's just impossible to try and grow her business at the moment, and she's now looking to try and enter other markets around the world that offer a bit more stability.
Every day is something happening. Every day there's a price for a service that used to be 4x. Now it's 3x. Now it's 4x. It's going back again to 2x. It was very unstable. Second of all, our consumer is also unstable. They don't want to buy because they don't know how much will this be in 1 month. Do I really need it, or do I have the money for it now? So the new challenge is securing hard currencies in the most ethical way so we can grow the business on the in the international level to avoid, let's say, the burdens of the Egyptian currency.
That was really interesting from Yara. Which industries are being hit hardest, Hannah?
Well, tourism is a massive contributor to Egypt's economy, responsible for almost a quarter of the country's GDP and employing 3 million people. And when a conflict is happening nearby, tourism numbers tend to decline. And that's exactly what happened in Egypt. The travel analytics firm Forward Keys estimates the number of flights to the Middle East has fallen by 35%. And for Egypt, tourism revenue has fallen by a similar amount, according to S&P Global. I spoke to Bassam El-Shamir, and he's a tour guide in Cairo, and he has definitely seen a change.
People don't want to travel to places which is even near to wars. Why should you? Are you expecting lesser number if more of the wars and more of the military activities which are taking place around Egypt will happen? Yes, of course. And the way how to save tourism in Egypt in case of more wars or more military activities is in one sentence, internal tourism. Tourism of the people within, in the Egyptian society, living on the land of Egypt. That's what I propose to the authorities, to start from now kind of preparing for it.
Bassem might be onto something there, focusing on domestic tourism, because that is on the rise in Egypt, but it won't give the country the foreign currency that it needs to make sure that it can pay for its debts and also pay for the imported goods that it needs for people living there. And it isn't just tourism that's been impacted. The Suez Canal has also seen a substantial drop in revenue. The canal is a key global trade route and an important source of foreign currency for Egypt. It's now been a year since we first saw Houthi rebels starting to attack ships passing along that canal in response to Israel's attacks on Gaza, which has meant that many commercial shipping companies have chosen to abandon that route entirely and instead take a longer route around the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. And the canal has seen around a 60% drop in trade altogether.
And with the conflict between Israel and Gaza still ongoing, we're unlikely to see much change for Egypt, are we?
That's right. It's unlikely that ships are going to return to the Suez Canal whilst war is going on so nearby. And when it comes to tourism, the Egyptian government have recruited a new tourism minister who's keen to boost visitor numbers. He's been offering incentives to prop up airlines flying to certain destinations and also reimbursing tour operators for marketing programs to try and increase the number of visitors to the country. So we'll just have to wait and see, really, if those investments pay off.
Really interesting stuff, Hannah. And you can hear all of that on Business Daily. Just search for that wherever you get your podcast. Hannah Mullane, thank you so much. And your World Business Report from the BBC World Service. To Spain now, Valencia's regional president Carlos Mazón is to announce government changes after facing criticism over his handling of the deadly October flash floods, which killed more than 200. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez will address lawmakers about the response to the disaster. The BBC's economics editor Faisal Islam has been speaking to Carlos Cupero, Spain's Minister for Economy, Trade and Business, and asked if the government response was good enough.
You can understand the anger. Of course, they are suffering, as I said, loss of lives. More than 200 lives have been lost. There's still missing people. So it's very understandable, the anger.
It's shocking. I mean, Valencia is an advanced city. It's unbelievable, is it not? That dozens, hundreds of people have died in a city, in a country as advanced as Spain, and in a city like Valencia.
But that gives you an idea of the magnitude of this natural disaster. Actually, we have, when you look at insurance policies and how many people are actually now asking for an insurance refund, so the extent of what was one day of those phone calls is usually what they do in 1 year. So the central government is doing all which is in our hands. There will be need for reconstruction And that's going to take, as I said, not just a few months, it's going to take a few years, and we will be there still.
Now, given what's happened in Spain in recent weeks, it was obvious that your prime minister in Baku made a very emotional plea about how climate change is killing people. What do you, as a Spanish government, mean by that?
Actually, what we're seeing today is an increase in frequency in these events and also an increase in the impact. When you look also at the different determinants of the floods, the time range is getting shorter and shorter. And also usually they happen early in the year, but now the temperature of the Mediterranean is higher. So it's undoubtedly there is a connection between climate change and what's going on.
What's your message to the incoming US administration if they were indeed to go through with a universal blanket 10 to 20% tariff on everything coming into America from foe, but from friend like Spain or the UK too?
It's a general message. First, that I think these tit-for-tat sort of protectionist measures are a lose-lose situation for everyone. We know that there is in no one's interest to enter this sort of trade war races. So we will be, of course, welcoming the new administration with open arms to develop, keep on developing that relationship. The transatlantic relationship is key for Europe and actually for Spain. The US is a key trading and investment partner.
That was Carlos Cupero, Spain's Minister for Economy, Trade and Business, speaking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam, who joins us now. Hello, Faisal. Faisal, Cupero warned about the risks of a lose-lose trade situation if the US implemented new tariffs. How could those tariffs specifically affect Spain's economy?
Well, I think in general terms, we've considered this potential tariff trade war as being a sort of US-EU thing or a US-China thing. I think there's many different elements to the potential three-dimensional chess that occurs. If, as seems likely, given the direction of travel in terms of the appointments being made by President-elect Trump, if they do transpire, then you have this universal tariff of 10 to 20% for everybody, and potentially 60% for China. Now, where Spain's economy, as you heard in that interview clip, Spain's economy has been outperforming most advanced economies. It's actually due to growing faster than America this year. One of the tricks of the Spanish outperformance here has been that they have been more open to Chinese investment. They've identified the notion that China has cornered the market in various green manufacturing, and they're encouraging investment. They're encouraging, for example, Chinese electric vehicle manufacturers to set up, even as they're being tariffed by the European Union. This and the extra next generation funds from the EU, all these sorts of things. Now, if the US was not just to impose tariffs, but encourage allies further bilaterally to tariff China, which is a pressure you may well get, that is the sort of thing that might come under pressure. But it was pretty clear. I mean, we've heard this briefed from European Union sources that there is a counter list of US exports which could be tariffed by Europe if the US goes through with their plans.
Yeah.
I think when I pushed him there, it was pretty clear. He said it was a no-brainer that the European Union would do that. Wouldn't list what was on there. Obviously doesn't want this to happen, but I think we're getting to a realisation that this might well happen. And the plans for if you like, retaliation or some sort of effort to try and disincentivise this from happening from the States.
And that's a conversation, I'm sure, that's happening as the G20, it's kicking off in Brazil. Spain's attending, even if it's not a member. What are we expecting from the G20 this week? What kind of conversations?
Well, it's the phrase elephant in the room. It's never been more appropriate than at this G20 meeting in Brazil, which is still a very, this was a forum that was set up in the aftermath of the great financial crisis to spread the conversation beyond the G7 advanced Western industrialized nations and to include countries like China and India, major oil producers like Saudi Arabia, the Brazilians and Argentina too. And so it is an important conversation. It played an important role in preventing a tit-for-tat, beggar-thy-neighbour trade war in the aftermath of the great financial crisis a decade and a half ago. And now it stands there, then everyone meeting, President Biden still there, President Biden having a bilateral meeting with Xi Jinping, and everybody wondering exactly what the president-elect in Mar-a-Lago is actually going to do. And as I said in my previous answer, It was really rather interesting to hear that there's a big debate now about who is going to appoint US Treasury Secretary. And one of the hopes in the markets is that that appointment of Treasury Secretary, as it did in his first term, would temper down the push towards tariffs. It doesn't look like that dynamic is going to work. And those tariffs that were threatened during the election campaign are going to be real. So that is what they'll be talking about. It's not on the agenda every single G20 meeting, every single bilateral meeting. They're going to be thinking exactly what is coming in January.
It's a lot. It's a lot, isn't it, Faisal? Well, we really appreciate you being on the programme. Faisal Islam there. And joining us also is Rachel Winter, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Hello, Rachel.
Hi there.
Rachel, do the markets pay attention to big meetings like these in Rio? What would they be looking out for? Any movements in the markets because of that?
Well, I think they definitely pay attention. They're looking out for comments on common themes like climate change. And they're also keen to hear about how well these big countries are getting on, because cooperation and peace between these countries is generally better for economic growth, whereas conflict can be bad for economic growth. So I think countries will be noting that Russia is not attending, whereas China is, and we'll be keen to hear about the comments relating to those countries as the conference goes on.
Interesting. Tesla's shares are up today. Why is that?
Well, it's because Elon Musk is getting on very well with Donald Trump. So it is expected that Donald Trump will pass legislation that will benefit Tesla. The particular news today is about a relaxation of the rules for robo-taxis. And that's an area that Tesla is looking to invest in. And any relaxation of the rules would be very good news for Tesla going forward.
And last one from the US, moving from cars to planes. Spirit Airlines, that was a big budget airline. It's filed for bankruptcy protection today. It hadn't been doing very well for a while, though, had it?
No, it hadn't. So as you say, it was a budget airline, so it had very, very small profit margins. And it really seems to have been hit by the rise in wages that has happened post-COVID. And so it has been more difficult for airlines to employ people post-COVID. And also there has been an increase in the minimum wage in the US. And that really seems to have squeezed the margins of Spirit too far. And unfortunately, the company has had to file for bankruptcy today.
Okay, Rachel Winter, partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. We appreciate your time. Now, meet Sergey, a 7-year-old programming prodigy from Russia.
Здравствуйте, мои дорогие подписчики. Сегодня мы будем создавать модель классификации на...
That's Sergey, teaching computer code on his YouTube channel, where he's helping thousands of people. His skills are so impressive, the Russian IT company Pro32 has already offered him a job, which he'll take up when he's 14 years old. Earlier today, I spoke to the CEO of Pro34, Igor Mantik, from Moscow.
Of course, in addition to their developer skills that are absolutely unique for this age, Sergey is just 7, but he has an equally unique or useful skill of teaching others. And you can see how he teaches other people on his YouTube channel. And for me, it looks like absolutely amazing. He has been teaching other people when he got 5. And for me, it's a kind of a new Mozart.
It really is unbelievable. How would you imagine him working in your company?
We sent him an offer to be head of a teaching department in our company. But unfortunately for us, and I think unfortunately for Sergey too, according to Russian law, it's prohibited to work in a company before you got 14. So we will be waiting for he get a 14 and will join our company.
And what position would he take up as a 14-year-old?
What position? Head of teach department.
Wow. So he'll be a big boss in your company.
Of course, of course. And I'm absolutely sure that when he gets 14, he'll be a guru of teaching and guru of developing. And that is why we're really looking forward for this time.
What could some of your staff learn from someone like Sergey?
I think that absolutely everything, but we will definitely start with developing skills, not just for our developers, but for the rest of the company, like, for example, accountants or maybe even sales managers. Why not? Because I think that today, nowadays, it's incredibly important to understand something about developing software products.
Mm. And did you have to explain this job offer to Sergei's parents, and what was their reaction?
Of course, we did. And his father, Kirill, was surprised. And he said that, wow, we are really happy and are looking forward for ability to join here. Sergei will be able to join your company. And now we are looking for any possibilities how to cooperate before he gets 14.
I presume Sergei himself was really excited to get the job offer too.
Unfortunately, I hadn't have an ability to talk to him personally, but I hope that he will find the time and we will enjoy a conversation about teaching peoples and about developing and just about life.
And have you had to do negotiations about salary, how much he'll earn?
Not yet, and I don't think that we should do it right now, because once again, we have to wait for 7 years, and I think that his salary can grow before in this time, and that is why we should maybe wait until he got 14, and then we will definitely start conversation about his salary.
Well, I hope Sergei negotiates hard. That was CEO of Moscow company Pro32, Igor Mandik. And that's it for this edition of World Business Report. I'm Liana Byrne, and Rahul Tandon will be back later at 22:30 GMT. And they'll be looking at the G20 summit, which is getting underway in Rio with a host of world leaders in attendance.